I'm going to offer a little more of a guided meditation tonight, though I'll try to keep my words to the minimum. We're focusing on mindfulness, and one of the things the Buddha recommended being mindful of were the so-called four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. There are different ways of interpreting these elements, and I'll offer a particular interpretation. And I suggest that you explore these aspects of experience both in terms of the sense of material reality, including the physical reality of the body, and also explore these four elements as aspects of experience, so that there can be a sense of how the body is like the world. The body is the world acting locally in terms of the material objective aspects of these four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And also how, by extension, the mind is also the world acting locally in terms of the ways in which experience has these qualities. I'll name each of the four, and from time to time, in order, I'll suggest to focus on each one of them in your mindfulness. The first element, earth, could be understood as the sense of solidity or stiffness. For example, the sense of sitting upright, bones that are stiff, hard, and unyielding. And by extension, the unyielding, hard qualities of the chair you're sitting on, or the floor your feet are resting upon. The element of earth. And in the mind, this quality of fixity or solidity, such as the solidity or fixity of a view. As experience unfolds, you can see the ways in which points of view that are stable, familiar sensations in the body that have the same quality every time you go back to them, they too have this quality of stability, earthiness. There's also the quality of water, of flow and cohesion. So, for example, physically, there can be a sense of things pulling together. Like as you breathe, you can feel the muscles pulling together and contracting, coming together, cohering. You can also have a feeling of gravity, of the pull of the earth, cohering us to itself. That aspect of reality that's about things coming together. And in the mind, there too can be the sense of insight coming together, or the feeling of a viewpoint coalescing, coming together. Then there's the element of fire, which could be understood as the aspect of energy and dispersal. For example, exhaling, there could be a sense of release. In the world, there's the flow of energy, sunlight, turning into plants, turning into animals, altogether turning into the food we eat. The energy of other people coming at us. The energy it takes every day in terms of calories to operate the body. All that, the world acting locally, reality operating in your seat. No difference fundamentally in terms of these elements or aspects between what's happening in your body and the world altogether. And the mind, in the mind there too, you can find this element of fire, this element of dynamism, expansion, dispersal. It might feel like a flow of energy that you're experiencing mentally as it moves through your body. You can observe thoughts after they've coalesced, then dispersing, moving back out into disorder and passing away. The element or aspect of fire in the body and mind. And then last, we can be mindful of the element or aspect of air. And one way to take this is the dimension of space, the space in which things happen, the space occupied by a body in the larger volume or space of this room. The necessity of there being space for anything to appear or exist within it, such as your body. Also, the spaces in the body, the hollow parts inside the rib cage, even in the bones, there are many little spaces. And then going further down inside the body, as we now know, vast spaces at the scale of atoms and molecules. Vast spaces between molecules, within molecules, and inside atoms themselves. We literally, the body is mainly space. Here too, no difference between inside and outside, between the body and the universe. in terms of this element of air or space. In the mind as well, we find this aspect of space in our experience. Awareness as a kind of space in which thoughts and sensations, feelings, memories come and go. Sometimes you can recognize a sort of space between thoughts. Or more generally, a kind of space of possibility that allows new ideas or insights to emerge. Thus, we have four elements of reality, four aspects of reality to be mindful of: earth, water, fire, and air, which could be said to be the aspect of stiffness, unyieldingness, stability in terms of earth, the aspect of cohesion, coming together, in terms of water, the aspect of energy and dispersal in terms of fire, and the element of air, which could be taken as spaciousness, physically and mentally. And as we come to quiet now, with the opportunity to be mindful of these different aspects of both reality and our experience, one of the opportunities here is a deepening sense of reassurance and at-homeness as we recognize that the body and the world have the same nature in terms of these elements, and the mind as well has these elements operating within it. So there can be more of a relaxed feeling of extending out into the body and physical reality in a fluid, extending kind of way, and feeling supported and lived locally in terms of these elements by reality altogether. May you be mindful of solidity, cohesion, energy, and space. So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's June 8th, 2016. And in that guided meditation, we were exploring what the Buddha and his contemporaries 2,500 years ago in northern India referred to as the four elements of reality. And those elements being earth, water, fire, and air, sometimes described in a different order. And I emphasized here the sense of them in terms of earth as solidity or stability, water as cohering, coming together, cohesiveness, fire as energy or dispersal, and air as the aspect of space. And I drew your mindfulness toward being aware of those aspects of external physical reality as well as the physical body, and also being mindful of the ways in which those four qualities, if you will, can be found in our own experience. And I did that because as we are completing this first foundation of mindfulness in the body, next week I hope to explore with you what is perhaps the most formidable and for many people challenging aspect of mindfulness of the body, the recognition of the inevitable decay and passing away of the body itself, which happens to be particularly meaningful and poignant for me since on just the last Saturday, I laid my mother's and father's ashes to rest in a family cemetery up in Miles City, Montana. So before we get to that part, I thought it was important to lay a foundation of that which is ongoing, which can help us as a kind of refuge from which we can really open to seeing and find our way to peace with that which will inevitably pass away. So as context, it's interesting that in Buddhism, there's a real emphasis, as you know, on impermanence, transience, a kind of way of identifying oneself as a Buddhist in the centuries after the Buddha himself passed away, was in the formula of essentially, I recognize impermanence. That was the calling card of an identified Buddhist, the recognition of impermanence. It was that central. So there is this emphasis on impermanence. What's interesting is that as one in your own practice penetrates more and more deeply into a recognition of transience, of endings, of passings away, paradoxically, what you start to become more aware of is that which is a reliable, enduring basis for happiness. You know, in effect, you could say that what the Buddha was profoundly interested in was that which is not impermanent. Because his own journey, his own quest, through the meditative traditions of his time, trained intensively as a yogi in a number of traditions that he mastered and found ultimately incomplete, and then he moved on to one after another, he was interested in that which was not subject to arising and passing away, that which was not conditioned, because that which is subject to being conditioned will always pass away. He was interested in what he called the deathless, the unconditioned, an enduring, reliable basis for lasting happiness. And as a way, and on the basis of that recognition, a way to disengage from what was fundamentally contracted and unsatisfying, ephemeral, and unreliable. Isn't that interesting? To frame Buddhism, to frame this practice in that way, as essentially finding our ways to take a kind of stand in that which is a truly reliable, enduring basis for profound, lasting inner peace and love and happiness. So I want to draw your attention to this consideration of the four elements as an aspect of that. In other words, when I first came across the four elements, I thought it was a bunch of medieval hooey. You know, how do you relate to earth, wind, fire? Sounds like a rock and roll band, right? Earth, air, water, wind, whatever they called, something like that. Yeah, there we are, earth, wind, and fire. You know, what happened to water? But anyway. And I remember I was on retreat, and I went for this little walk over at Spirit Rock, and I was carefully stepping around the poison oak on this trail that goes up the hill above the residence halls there, if you've ever been there. And I followed it all the way up toward where they will eventually put a hermitage site, kind of up in the boonies. And I was picking my way through the trails and reflecting on this elements thing. And I started identifying, okay, what's solid outside me? Like, rocks are really solid. And if you look at a tree and its branches, you could see the aspect of solidity in the branches. And I began to recognize that, wow, there was solid inside and there was solid outside. And in other words, what was here, in terms of the dimension of solidity, was just an extension of the solidity out there. You know, in this body, the solidity of calcium, bones, iron, you know, iron that makes a fork very solid, iron in our own blood, solidity there. Also the dimension of water, kind of things coming together, sticking together, patterns stabilizing, cohering and forming. You could see it out there in the world. You know, you could see water literally in the world, or you could recognize the water in that plant that was had some water in it. And you could also feel the water in the body, you know, inside, outside. No radical difference, no fundamental difference. And same with the dimension of fire. You know, the light sparking on the leaves, sun, energy. I could feel the warmth on my face. I could feel the warmth inside my own body. Same aspect of reality, warmth, energy. And also the sense of things is kind of dynamic and bouncing around and moving. You know, the aliveness in the body as well as the aliveness in the whole forest, the whole ecosystem around me. And then also, too, the dimension of air. You could think of the air you breathe in. We're inhaling the exhalations of trees. You know, we're exhaling their inhalations and other green-growing things. And you could also get a sense even of air as like volume in the body, spaciousness, as well as the space that I was moving through or the space that that was necessary for other things to exist, to find their space in those things. And so what that did actually for me in a way that started kind of as an intellectual recognition of what's true, you know. In other words, not some poetic metaphor or sentimental, cosmic, you know, kind of notion, but hardcore reality. Outside, inside, same. Same inside, same outside in terms of these, the nature of reality as having these four fundamental aspects, right, that you can find consistently inside and outside. And as I experienced that, I just got delighted and happy in the sense of, the dependability. You know, the particular pattern will pass away. You know, this particular tree will pass away. This particular body will pass away. The bodies of my mother and my father have passed away. Houses will pass away. It was really interesting to go to the family property, the ranch, about 15 square miles, middle of North Dakota, or actually southwestern corner. And for my father some years ago to show me where he grew up as a boy. He said, I grew up right over there, Rick. And I look over there, I see nothing but brush and grass. Like what? Oh, sorry. Where he was born was a sod house, walls 3 feet thick. That's really gone. Can't locate it. But where he grew up was over there. And I, well, what's over there? I look over there. All I can see is one L-shaped foundation, a handful of concrete, you know, sort of placements. Otherwise, it's all gone. Walls are gone. Fixtures are gone. It's gone. I'm sure in 1,000 years, if not a lot sooner, it will really be. You would need to be an architect to identify where it once was. Or archaeologist, that's what I meant to say. So anyway, point being, that even though those patternings of reality pass away, these fundamental aspects of reality continue. They just pattern and express themselves in different ways elsewhere. And if you can kind of feel that, you can feel that what's here is just sort of a local expression of these four aspects of reality altogether operating locally. And with that, so that made me really happy. I'm trying to offer that happiness to you, and it starts intellectually. Trust me, it was very abstract for me initially, but I began to see more and more it's actually really true. Just see, if you hit your hand like that, you can feel the same solidity in your hand than if you, you know, knock on chair. You know, you can, et cetera. And then to take it a step further to the mind, it's wild. You can find the solidity in the mind. You can find cohering in the mind. You can find energy and dispersal in the mind, and you can find space in the mind. There I was sitting here during the break. And what happened in my mind was I could, over about a second or so, a thought stabilized, solidified, in the form of a plan. I'm going to get out of here right on time, get home, watch that basketball game, and that's how it's going to be. You see? Cohering, coming together. You can kind of feel it. Right? Right, right. Don't tell me a word. No words. And then I observed it in spaciousness, started laughing at myself, thought, that's a good example for everyone. A little later, and then whoosh, it was on to the next thing. So you can see, same inside, same outside. And that sense of inside, outside can be very reassuring, actually. Yeah, the local ripple in the river. So there's a river, a current, and a ripple. The ripple in the current will pass away. The current has more stability, but it too, the current of an individual life. The ripples of thought, of feeling, of plan, of desire, of organizing how your living room looks, you know, whatever that local patterning is, the job, the routine, and so forth, those ripples will pass away. The stream of your life will have more persistence over time, like a standing wave, right? But eventually, even that current will itself disperse into the river of reality. And yet also, of course, the current of your life and the ripple of some pattern or other inside the mind or in the arrangements of your life, that current of your life, that little ripple are just a local expression of the river of allness. That's the truth of things. It sounds abstract, it's an idea, but you can really recognize, wow, that's actually the way it is. And then what happens when you recognize that that's the way it is? Because that's very much the practice, is the embodied, the feeling of knowing that that's really the way it is. One signal of that is the feeling, in a certain sense, of reassurance. There's a calming, it's kind of tranquilizing, it's happy-making when you realize this. Yes, patterns disperse, but allness continues as a reliable basis for lasting happiness. So we're back, all right? So we're still with the stuff about what is stable and lasting, and as an exploration, you know, as an encouragement. And so I want to read you this passage here from Anallio's book on the mindfulness, Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I think it's probably the best book I know on mindfulness, really. You know, it takes a little attention, but it's clearly written, and it's something you just come back to again and again and again. And I'm going to try to read a little passage here about the implications of all this, and then see what you make of it. So I'll just read it. He says here, feelings themselves are not suffering, nor is their impermanence suffering, But all feelings, all thoughts, all sensations are unsatisfactory since none of them can provide lasting satisfaction. See the distinction? It's not that they're suffering, right? So there's the thing, the first noble truth is dukkha, translated perhaps as suffering or stress, that quality of life, the unsatisfactoriness of life, if you will, okay? That is, dukkha, as an aspect of all conditioned phenomena, is not necessarily experienced as suffering, since suffering requires someone sufficiently attached in order to suffer. In other words, if you are at peace with this unsatisfactoriness of conditioned, transient phenomena, if you're at peace with that fact of lived experience and larger, most aspects of material reality, then you won't suffer. That to suffer is due to some form of attachment is in fact the implication of the second noble truth, according to which, in order for the unsatisfactory, transient nature of phenomena in the world to lead to actual suffering, it is necessary for craving to be present, to be attached to that which is passing away. The passing awayness is not a problem. The compoundedness of reality is not a problem. The fact that these ripples in the current, in the river of reality, are all passing away is not inherently a problem. As the third noble truth of cessation or freedom, liberation, indicates, once all traces of attachment and craving have been eradicated, such suffering is also eradicated. Thus, suffering, unlike unsatisfactoriness, is not inherent in the phenomena of the world, including in the mind, only in the way in which the unawakened mind experiences them. I'll read that again. Suffering, unlike unsatisfactoriness, is not inherent. It only arises in the way in which the unawakened mind experiences the phenomena of the world. This is indeed the underlying theme of the Four Noble Truths as a whole. The suffering caused by attachment and craving can be overcome by awakening. Then the unsatisfactory nature of all conditioned phenomena is no longer capable of causing suffering. There will be no midterm. Okay, that's hardcore. What do you make of it? Let's try to unpack it and help it come into our own lived experience, or at least begin to. What do you think? Great.
Well, it's theoretical in a way, because it's like that's the perfect place when you have no attachment. We all
right.
Have some at some level, and we're going to suffer because
yeah.
We like that, and it's yeah. Going to go away, and then we're not going to like that.
Yeah.
And hurt. So it's, and I don't know if there's anyone, well, maybe the Dalai Lama or Buddha, so doesn't have that condition, but I don't know anybody personally that wouldn't suffer by having their car stolen or the house burned down or something like that.
Well, that's a really good, there are a lot in what you said, you're right. It is that attaching that causes suffering. Then there's the question, really empirically, first, are there people who are, the way I look at it is, can I look backward that way, and can I look forward this way? If I look backward that way, especially as I look farther back, I see a guy who is more and more attached, myself. Contracted, reactive, positional, hooked by craving more readily. Angry or afraid of what was unpleasant, grasping after me, my, what was pleasant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And I look forward and I can kind of see the trend. And also I can see people who I know and I observe and I look at them and they have more freedom in their minds than I do. You know, things happen. You're right, including they lose their car, and maybe it's unpleasant. They wish they didn't have a car. Maybe you know, their social nature. There's a feeling of hurt or injustice or feeling unprotected by others. You know what the Buddha referred to is, you probably know the metaphor, first starts of life. You know, yuck, but they don't get upset about it. That those experiences arise in a spaciousness of insight and, you know, undisturbedness in their core. And I can kind of see that, and that gives me confidence that I can keep on going. And I can also feel it in the transmission of people who are no longer alive, but you read their stuff, look at their videotape if you can, and you go, wow, far out. Like, I'm reading a book by Suzuki Roshi recently. I bet Tarane knows it. Not Always So. These beautiful talks. You just read one of those talks and your mind starts evaporating. So I could see that. So I think that it's possible. One. And two, in your own mind, what's interesting is we can directly see often the part of us, maybe, that's craving and attached. Can't you also, we also experience often there are parts, even alongside those first parts, that are relaxed and understand and somehow at peace. It's like this part is really upset, and yet this part is really at peace. I remember when I, the first time I had a melanoma diagnosis, you know, and I'd had my brother-in-law recently die of it at the time. This was about 5-6 years ago. And for about 10 days, I had no idea what the outcome was going to be, you know. And if you've ever been through something like that, you can probably relate to what I'm talking about. You just don't know. And at the end of the 10 days, UCSF very skillfully scooped it out of my ear. I'm fine, you know. They just took it out because it was sitting right on the very tip top of the skin. But during that 10-day period, you know, as I've said, you may have read this, because I wrote it one time, it was like my mind had three layers to it. The top layer was problem solving, you know, what are we going to do, different treatments, how do I schedule this? I had to cancel a whole trip to Europe, a bunch of teaching, forget it, blah, 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 blah. Then there was this deeper layer. There was like a scared little soft furry animal. I just wanted to curl up in my corner and be hugged, you know, really primal. And then the deepest layer, truly, was completely at peace with whatever would happen. So you could say that some of those top two layers had a fair amount of craving in them, but to some extent. But there was another part that just was really, really okay. You know, and I bet you can find those layers or those parts even inside your own mind. Yeah, think about that. Okay? And so the key thing isn't the fact of existence, the facts, including those elements. It's our relationship to them. And that's just really remarkable. Suffering itself is not inherent. You know, the classic line, pain is inherent, but suffering is not. You know, suffering is optional. Okay, great. Sylvia.
The thing is, I was amazed because I was reading a book, which I actually left to you to pass on, but it was saying the stages, and I practiced it this weekend, and it's... In some ways, Rick, it was frightening, and in some ways I was amazed, because what you do is you actually, there's things, they say the Buddha did the more esoteric, where they, you know, they either did from phenomena from drugs to, or you do the thing where you jog, or, you know, you just have to lift yourself out of our comfort zone, because the thing is, the awareness comes when we're not complacent, because when we're too complacent, we do the same routine, we do the, and we don't switch it up or something like that. So it was pretty neat. I was doing these different things, and I was also being aware of my environment. And I'll tell you one thing that kind of shocked me. So I go to Small Claims Court, and I'm going to make this real short, and the fellow that sat there just listened, but the judge was here, and he says, well, so you're saying that you did the $600 thing and she got nothing? He says, and the guy goes, oh, well, you know, like he was making a joke. And the judge said, you know what? And he kind of went like to his feet, which he said, I've been a real complaint in $600. And then I said, I thought it was kind of, you know, I knew that the guy was being mature. And I said, I forgive you. And then the funny thing is, the whole court knew except me. And that's why I'm going to go. And they said, no, 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 you wait here. I thought, I really meant it. Let's forgive them. But they're saying that because the environment now, people were angry.
Yeah.
So they don't want you to walk out and somebody to, because, you know, nowadays the environment's been angry.
Yeah.
A lot of rage and things going on. So it just brought me to a level to be more aware. And that's also saying, if you practice, I think you could drop that because it is an illusion. It's an illusion to think death is bad, just like something else. We thought that. It's a,
that's great.
We call it a computer. If you learn it, you can unlearn it. And it does feel better when we do that. But it takes a lot of practice. It took a lot of
practice. It's true. Thank you. No, really. To your point, too, that's the takeaway, isn't it? It takes practice. Yeah.
Can you address your definition of reality?
Oh, sure. That's very good. I've thought about that a lot, right? And I still remember that Mark and Mindy's Robin Williams line, reality, what a concept, you know, right? And what do we mean by that? Or what do you mean? But we can keep going down that rabbit hole a long way. I mean it really simply for me. We start with mind. We start with experience. There is experience, right? There is hearing, there is seeing. We're really clear about that part. The rest, we're just inferring, you know? But there is hearing, there are sounds, you know, like sensations. You're sitting in a chair, you know, there we have sensation. There is experience. Maybe the experience is amplified by telescopes or microscopes, but at the end of the day, all there is experience, phenomenology, you know, from which we infer that there probably is also some kind of physical reality, you know, rocks and sticks and water, including weird stuff like photons and black holes and dark energy and stuff like that. So for me, when I use the word reality, I mean, first, materiality, physical reality, the universe, this universe, whatever else is the case, this universe. And also, I think of information as existent, but immaterial. So there are, if you think of it, experience, the nature of experience, including our experience of seemingly solid things, experience itself is not solid. You cannot weigh a sensation. You cannot weigh a thought. See what I'm saying? So those two together, I think of as reality.
So
also, I think there's stuff outside the box, but that's another story. Yeah.
So when you were speaking about the ripples and, the and how some of those, the current of our life is experienced by thoughts and emotions and mind. I'm a student of A Course in Miracles.
Great.
And so I love to bring
profound
the
book. Yeah.
Together. And it seems to me that which is changeless is the reality that we can base the ever-present peace and happiness on.
Yeah.
And so my question kind of when you asked about reality was when you described
what you just said right there,
that
which is changeless is a reliable basis for lasting happiness.
Yeah.
And you're using the word reality to describe that which is changeless, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just semantics, really. Like you're not speaking that we because we accept that things go away and change. If we can accept it, then we are happy.
Yeah, and I think that, and again, it can seem very abstract, but when you get it as when you feel the truth of it, it's like the feeling of knowing it's true. It really gets you, and it's that. Everything inside reality, most things inside, well, most physical things change. You know, there are certain things that don't change, you know, in terms of physical reality. Like there's a conservation of energy, but even in the universe, it seems like energy is being pumped into it to make it expand. That's what dark energy is. So even that, wow. So my point is, it's like trees grow and die, you know? Planets come together, suns happen, the sun's going to actually expand over the next 3-4 billion years, finally to swallow the Earth and then contract to a white dwarf. That's really going to happen. You know, all this gone in that, you know, a few 4 billion years from now, don't worry, but, you know, your kids are going to be okay meanwhile. You know what I mean? Like that. But so all that's, the parts change, but the whole as a whole never changes. The whole as a whole is always almost in that sense. And then you could, from the Course in Miracles standpoint, there's some kind of transcendental frame in which that stuff is occurring. And see what's real for you. What's real for you. And the key takeaway, I think, is this exploration of both that which is transient and unreliable and that which is unconditioned and reliable. That's the real exploration.
Hi, I'd like to share something about the meditation tonight, which put a frame of reference to me on something that I've been doing for a very long time. When my husband and I go up to the mountains, I've always felt like there were teachers and lessons to me there. And I've always liked them listening and looking for them. It starts with the rocks, particularly granite, which is so ancient, so solid, so slowly changing, so much the same, even when things around it come and go, and you know, me sitting on it, me laying on it, putting my tent on it, but it's still constant and steady. Yeah. And then there's the water. The water particularly sucks me in because it's always changing, you know, from the ground to the skin, to the stream, to the waterfall, to the lake, to back up to the clouds, and pulling apart and coming together again. And it always changing, and always itself.
That's exactly it.
And it's just, it amazes me every time I see my waterfall. And then there's the sun, you know, just feeling the energy on my skin and you know, all the plants around and seeing them take that energy and make it its own. And then for me, into me from the plants, making it my energy. And my husband and I have this little mantra when we hike, particularly up on high hills. It only takes energy. Feeling this cycle of energy that and then there's the space, which I've always thought of. I hadn't thought of the space in the air. You really gave that to me. But laying under the stars, you know, sleeping at night, looking up and thinking about, okay, how far up is the air going? And like, when is there no more molecules? When does it sort of blend into nothingness? And then thinking about the universe, and then it's sort of in this envelope of emptiness. And then thinking about the tiny, tiny universes that still exist on the speck of dust or on that little piece of moss or whatever, and how that expands, and then my skin, you know, how the molecule of me is next to a molecule that's not me, but yet that boundary is not so different. And it's just these teachers are out there, and it brings to me this incredible sense of tranquility every time I listen to these lessons. It's a very addictive feeling.
Can you say, this is so beautiful, I'm thinking, wow, you should have led the meditation. But, how did it bring you to tranquility? That's what I was trying to get at. What is it about that recognition that you really beautifully said that drew you into tranquility?
It makes me feel part of the all. I think all is part of me. And then it again, it the pain and agony of dragging myself up and down the hills and carrying my backpack and all of a sudden, it doesn't matter. You know, the things
matter
so much less when I look at. My husband and I used to look at the rocks and go, eons and eons. These rocks have been here for eons and eons. And these trees, these trees are really old. It puts us in perspective.
Really,
makes me feel much calmer about life because, you know, it's awesome.
That's so great. Just to quote you again, you're part of the all. And the all is part of you, right? All true for all of us too.
So thank you very much. I've never put it together into the frame of reference of earth, water, fire, and air.
Yeah.
This is just a lovely thing.
All right. Well, from the Buddha through me, 2,500 years later. That's really nice. Thank you. Wow. Last person.
Do you think it's possible to lead a sufferingless, cravingless life in our culture, or do you have to go away to a monastery to do that, or what level of, you know, craving and suffering do you think the most evolved, most dedicated Buddhist meditator?
So it's a beautiful question. You know, if we want to do anything, it helps to study people who are really good at it, right? When I was rock climbing a lot, I would watch people who are very good at it and kind of channel them. Or you know, if I want to like swing a tennis racket, I would go Roger Federer, whoosh, Roger Federer, whoosh, right? Same way, you know, I think it is very helpful to get a sense of people who are very far along, and people have different exemplars. You know, I think of when I read like Suzuki Roshi's Mindstream in his book, or someone like Nisargadatta, or you know, Christian mystics who are just, I think of them as just blown wide open, or for me, the living person who I myself seems just to be the most developed is Thich Nhat Hanh for me personally. I think there are perhaps others who are, perhaps are subtleties of complete awakening that are maybe even a step further, but they're really part of far along. And so I do think of Thich Nhat Hanh, peace advocate, very politically engaged, very prolific, very involved in an organization, and very engaged when his own, when he had a very serious stroke. I mean, he's really fierce in his rehab. If you read the stories of what he's actually doing, he's committed. You know, he's fighting. He's engaged. He's 80-something plus. You know, so I myself, I think of this monk I saw in an airport once, and I was stressing and frazzled and can't get Wi-Fi, you know? And I was just watching him, and he was a Buddhist, I could tell, shaven head, and he just sat in there. He's in an airplane. He was in an airport, and you could just see he was just, because it's always allness, right? It's always all allness. And wherever you are, you know, it was like, it was totally okay. So I myself am hopeful of how far it's possible to be. And as you know, I feel it really helps for householders to repeatedly internalize the enjoyable felt sense of broadly defined peace and contentment and love, which undermines the biological engines of craving, which are so readily stimulated by householder life. They're less triggerable in a monastery. You know, you can still get triggered there, but it's designed to be less triggering. If you're going to live in this world of wonders, you really have to have your shit together. I don't normally swear when I'm giving a Dharma talk, but I just think it's true, right? And so that to me just says, okay, if we're going to live in this world, we really have to practice, because we've got this inner lizard, mouse, and monkey that they want their cheese, you know? That's what I really feel. And yet paradoxically, maybe I'll wrap on this point, householder life gives us many, many opportunities to experience in our bodies peace and contentment and love. So it's kind of like it both is a challenge to be awake, to awaken in householder life, but on the other hand, householder life gives us all kinds of resources and ways to deepen our awakening personally. And then at the end of all that, for me, the question is always, and I leave you with this, what's the next step? We can get quite caught up in, you know, wow, will I ever get to the top of the mountain, right? What's it like up there? Has anyone ever been up there before? You know, why am I walking uphill, right? Or you could just look, do I believe in the next step? Do I have confidence in it? Does it make sense to me? What's my next step tonight? What's my next step tomorrow? You know, where am I going in my practice? You know, when I'm 10 steps down the road, 10 weeks down the road, and I look back, what am I doing so that there's a little difference over time in practice? You know, that's what I think. So that would be my invitation to you. And just to finish here, to see if it's useful to you, this exploration of the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, however you take those, and this broader consideration of what is stable, what is reliable, you know, how is allness happening locally? How are we simply, you know, a local streaming in the total, you know, river of everything?
Is that a form of channeling, what you just said? So that basically is the water. So channeling the higher, channeling the sounds and the sensations. That's channeling.
If you can relate to it that way, sure. And people do it that way. So let's sit for a minute. We'll wrap up. Go Warriors. responding a little further to the last or next to last comment, a deeper answer is I'm really hopeful because our natural condition is everything. Buddha nature. Our natural condition is the river. We are the river, our reality. That's our natural condition. That's why I'm hopeful about awakening. May you be everything locally. It's true. See you next week.